Good morning, everybody. My name's Don Major, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be anywhere, especially here. I am so grateful to be here and with dear old friends that I love a lot, and meeting new friends. And I had to chide Clancy a little bit last night by asking him what color the private plane was they sent for him to come. And my friend Charles over there was sweet enough to fly from here to Louisville and pick up Tim and me and bring us down. So just really, really grateful. And I'm supposed to talk about steps 1, 2, and 3, and I suspect I can do that, but I'm going to talk a little bit about me first, just so that those of you who haven't heard my story have a feel for where I come from. I've got an ego disorder that I've had all my life, and that's the heart of my alcoholism. And on account of that ego disorder, without divine intervention, or if that offends you intellectually, call it the magic from the steps, and it'll get you to the same place, and it won't offend your intellect so terribly. Without that divine intervention, I'm so obsessed with myself. I'm so obsessed with how I believe I stack up against other people in this world, and I'm so obsessed with how I feel that for many years I boiled my alcoholism, or the bedrock of it, down to one sentence. And that one sentence of where it all starts with me, I believe, is that without divine intervention, I'll always wind up letting how I feel be the most important thing in the world to me. And all that obsession with myself has had the only effect that I really think it can have on a human being. It's always created so much pain and so much emptiness down inside me, and so much apartness and differentness from the rest of the world. And I've never been able to feel good enough inside that I could stand it without divine intervention, without either running as hard as I could and or stuffing something in there. And I got drunk the first time when I was 12 or 13, and the magic that we, almost all of us have some version of this story. I didn't know it was magic at the time. All I knew at the time was that for a few minutes on my way to puking and getting in all that trouble and blacking out and passing out, I had passed through a right pleasant neighborhood. But the truth is, the magic had happened, because for the first time in my life, when I got enough of that booze in me, all that pain and that emptiness and that apartness and that differentness went away, and I was okay with myself. I was okay with everybody and everything around me. And remember that how I feel is the most important thing in the universe without divine intervention. And I can assure you I was not looking for any of that back then. So my powerlessness over alcohol, and in later years the things like it, I don't think has any mystery in it at all. I think it's a no-brainer. It couldn't have been any other way. Alcohol dominated my life for 25 years. I functioned on the surface at a pretty good level for a long time. Somehow I got through undergraduate law school and had a fairly successful law practice. Had a catastrophic automobile accident in February 1978. And that and the alcoholism kept me out of the law practice, and for about a year of it, living without an address for 5 years, lost literally everything. Was so hard-headed that once I got myself moved from Nashville, where I was in Vanderbilt Hospital, because the wreck had happened closer to Vanderbilt, after about 6 or 7 weeks, because they didn't know who I was down in Nashville and didn't treat me with nearly the appropriate deference, I got myself moved back to Louisville, where they knew who I was. And I guess they did, because after I got back every single day, and I'm laying there with the prognosis that I would never walk without at least a brace on one leg. and that no surgeon would ever attempt to restore my urinary function. And I'm laying there in that bed, and my friends are coming in and bringing me booze and more dope than the doctor's given me, and I would say really intelligent things. I would say things like, you know, fellas, anybody can stop drinking when the going gets a little tough. But it takes a man to lay in there with it when the bills start coming in. Give me another drink and let's go on with it. And that's insanity. And it's powerlessness. And when you really think about it, it's absolutely letting the way I feel be the most, in that moment, and the need to change it, be the most important thing in the universe. More important than my child, more important than my profession, more important than whether I ever walked, more important than whether I ever peed, more important than whether I lived or died. And a miracle happened in April of 1981, my sobriety date, by the grace of God, is April 9th, 81. And I'm not going to get into that miracle right this minute when I talk about step two. I probably will talk about it a bit. But a loving God that I didn't even know was there for me, that I wanted no truck with anything like that. First time I heard the third step read, I thought, my God, there's some sort of mythical crap they're talking about turning my will and life over to some sort of God thing they're talking about. And you can imagine how that insulted my intelligence. Now, I'm in an asylum when that happened. I've got braces on both legs. I've got a super pubic catheter in my belly and a catheter bag on my leg and on crutches. So when my intellect was so offended, I climbed up on my crutches and said as loud as I could, do you mean to tell me there are people in this world who believe such crap? And then I hobbled on over the telephone, payphone that Clancy described to you young folks last night, and I called somebody to come get me away from those religious fanatics before they polluted my pristine intellect. So the miracle that happened in April of 81 in my life, and I didn't know at the time that it happened. I didn't know anything had changed. But that loving God that I didn't know or didn't care was there, gave me the first tiny little bit of teachability or humility I'd ever had in my life. And what that means to me today is that I was given the first ability to follow some directions about how to run my life, even though I didn't understand them, I didn't agree with them, I didn't think they would work, and I certainly did not want to do them. And folks, that simple gift is the only reason on earth that I'm standing up here early on a Saturday morning talking to you beautiful, sweet folk, kind enough to get out of bed to come listen to me run my mouth, instead of having been rotting in a pauper's grave for over 36 years. I got sober, and I'm having a wonderful life, thank you. Now, let me talk about steps a little bit. It was explained to me early on, over and over, because I don't know why I had so much trouble understanding the difference between the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I did. And looking back on it, I don't know why, because it's the simplest thing in the world. The program is numbered 1 through 12. Nothing in the book is referred to as a program of recovery other than the 12 steps. And it was explained to me that actually the steps 1 through 9 are the recovery program in its entirety. My original sponsor, who was Cherry Carpenter in Nashville, Tennessee, explained that once I had done those steps exactly the way the big book said do them, when I finished step 9, I should be in a state of recovery from alcoholism and my ego would be deflated. Well, Cherry very quickly added that in my case, he expected that blissful state to last about 8 seconds. And then I would have to live on 10, 11, and 12 a day at a time the rest of my life in order to get my daily reprieve and live comfortably and productively with alcoholism. I'm not peddling this, but the way I was sponsored, and it works for me, I was sponsored that you only do steps 1 through 9 one time. Now, Terry added on that very quickly, that everything that is in steps 1 through 9 is encompassed in 10, 11, and 12. So consequently, in the morning when I read the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer, the 11th step prayer, I'm not redoing my third step. I'm not redoing seventh step. I'm doing 11th step work, seeking to improve my conscious contact with God. When I've done the many subsequent inventories that I've done over the years, and on the bigger ones, I've used exactly pages 64 through 70 in the big book. Looks exactly like a fourth step. But as far as I'm concerned, it's 10th step work. It's continuing to take personal inventory. And, you know, it took me 3 or 4 years sober to figure out why Cherry told me that. He told me that in the same vein that he would correct me when I referred to myself as a recovering alcoholic. And in 1981, that was just absolutely mandatory. You were a recovering alcoholic. But when I would say that, Cherry said, well, if you want to refer to yourself as recovering, that's fine. Said, but be aware that the big book refers to us as recovered. And by that time, I'd become pretty well a big book scholar. And so I said, well, Cherry, where have they hidden that in the big book? And he said, Don, the first place they hid it was in the subtitle of the book. I didn't even know the book had a subtitle. You know how so many men and women have recovered. And said, then in case you missed it, they hid it twice in the first paragraph to the foreword to the first edition. Well, it sounded like a bunch of semantics to me, and it may be. But I did finally figure out what Cherry was doing. He realized that if I was able to grab hold of the idea that I'm a totally and permanently defective, poor little alcoholic, and all I can do is just hope to get a little better and slog along in the mud and try not to mire down much deeper as I go along. Cherry knew that I was perfectly capable of 30 years sober, being sitting around a clubhouse somewhere playing euchre and whining about those earth people out there. I can't get out there and work with those people. I'll get drunk. They don't understand me. I'm from a different planet than those people. He wanted me to understand that once I'd done those first 9 steps the way the book says do them, in other words, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and was living on 10, 11, and 12 every day of my life, that I ought to be at least as well equipped to deal with this world on this world's terms as a person who had never had alcoholism. But at any rate, as I say, it may be semantics, but it's an angle of approach that I have found useful to me. Another thing that was explained to me, the fellowship, of course, is what we're doing right now. It's meetings. It's us talking with one another. It's us 12-stepping one another. It's a dance after Clancy's talk on Saturday night at a conference. They got me at 2:00 in the afternoon or something. It's all those wonderful things, and the fellowship is just absolutely necessary. It's absolutely necessary to support the process of recovery, the program of recovery, the 12 steps. But it was explained to me that if I got into AA and started going to meetings, got acclimated in it, made friends, got comfortable, and decided, well, or didn't, maybe just didn't decide one way or the other, but didn't go on with the steps the way the book says do it, that I was exactly like a person who went into the hospital with cancer and got some pain medication, and they got propped up and get to feeling pretty good. And I said, well, I'm not going to let those doctors cut on me to cut out this cancer. I'm doing just fine. They explained that what was inside me would eat me up. They said that I might be able to stay dry a week, or in some cases I might be dry 30 years. But if I did it that way, without the program of recovery, I would have absolutely no healing of that ego disorder, of that inability to be comfortable inside myself and live comfortably and productively in my own skin. They explained, too, that the 12 steps are indeed the prescription for alcoholism, that they work on alcoholism just exactly like penicillin works on an infection. If I've got an infection that will eventually kill me if it's not treated, but will respond to penicillin, I don't need to understand the origin, width, breadth, and nature of my infection. And I don't need to aggravate the medical profession and the people around me whining about that. The truth is, I could learn everything there is to know about that infection, become the greatest expert on earth, and I'd die just as dead as the guy that didn't know a thing about it. I don't need to believe that that little bottle of pills can take care of all these terrible things wrong with wonderful me. And the really important one for me is I don't need to want to take the pills. That's irrelevant, totally irrelevant. If I follow the directions, I'll get just fine, thank you. And they explained to me that I didn't need to worry about this old crazy picture show in the back of my head so much, that I need to worry about my actions. They explained to me that all these thoughts, feelings, and beliefs that have always been the center of my universe and without divine intervention still are today, that they're really just a will-o'-the-wisp. My thoughts, feelings, and beliefs did not hurt a soul or a thing during my drinking in and of themselves. It was what I did and what I failed to do. The only thing that's ever gone in the record is what I do. And thank my loving God, my recovery is the same way. You know, the first several years, a couple of years I was sober, I have trouble reading the big book. And the reason I have trouble reading the big book is I already know what it says. And if you already know what it says and you're going through there glancing, got that, It's a great discipline, and it's a necessary spiritual discipline. I do it, but as far as, you know, really getting anything different out of it, I'm not going to. But every once in a while, God will give me the grace of a moment of clarity and let me see what the ink on the paper says rather than what I have believed for yay number of years the book says. And one of the prime examples of that, the first couple of years I was sober, I would have sworn that the book said that my daily reprieve from alcoholism was contingent on my spiritual condition. And I won't tell you that was scary, because my spiritual condition is the way I am. And I don't have a magic wand on any given day to change the way I am on a day. So I believed on those days that I would wake up and feel like I was cut off from God and cut off from you guys, when I didn't want to get on my knees and pray, and I knew if I did, it wouldn't feel right. It'd be like the words were bouncing off the walls and ceiling, where the last thing I wanted to do was listen to another suffering alcoholic whine about something. that on days like that I was vulnerable, that I was exposed and might just be struck drunk. But when I finally did see what the ink on the paper said, the ink says that our daily reprieve is contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And guys, that's as dramatic a difference. as the lights in this room being on and off. Because when I realized that, and I love that word realize, I love words, and I think they're really important in recovery, and I always thought that to realize something was the same thing as knowing it. You know, I know that, I realize that, but realize is a form of the word real. When I have realized something, that literally means that it has become real inside me. And there are all sorts of things I've known for 30, 40 years that I have not brought into reality inside me. So I've realized that the book was saying that it didn't matter what was going through my head on those days, because you see, the maintenance of my spiritual condition, unlike my spiritual condition over which I'm immediately powerless, is a specific set of actions that is set out clearly in the big book, and I have hundreds of fellows in Alcoholics Anonymous to help me with those actions. And if I follow those actions, I am absolutely guaranteed that regardless of what's going on in the old crazy picture show, I will not drink today. So my daily reprieve went instantly from something totally beyond my control to something totally within my control. same thing happened with my attitude, by the way. Early sobriety, you know, everybody's always talking to you about your attitude. You got to change your attitude, boy. You better get an attitude of gratitude. If you don't straighten up your attitude, you're going to die. Well, I always wanted to go under the table when they talked to me about that, because I thought I knew, that my attitude was not very good most of the time, because the only definition of attitude I had ever even considered was the way I thought and felt about something, my mindset about something. Cherry sent me to an old 1930s dictionary and told me to look up attitude, and that always irritated me. I'm so much smarter than Cherry. I knew that, and that old man would tell me to do things like that. But I looked it up, and the first definition there was a definition from aviation and from geometry: angle of approach. So I realized that my attitude toward anybody or anything is not the way I'm feeling. It's not what the old crazy picture show is doing. My angle of approach toward anybody or anything is the way I behave toward those people and the actions that I do. So exactly like my daily reprieve, when I realized that, my attitude went from something totally beyond my control to something totally within my control. And I tell you, that's been life-changing over the years for me. Well, it was explained to me early on that steps one and two, I'm actually going to talk about them. Steps one and two are different from the rest of the steps. And the way they are different is all the rest of the steps require some specific action, and one and two don't necessarily require any action. One and two rather require that we reach conclusions. And by the way, I was told that they are not called the steps by accident or by default. They could have been called the 12 principles, the 12, 12 premises, you know, owner tenants, on and on. But they're called the steps because in a conventional staircase, the second step in that staircase actually rests on step one as its base. The second step in the conventional staircase really cannot exist without the first step. The same with the third on top of the second, so on. So Cherry was told me that if I had not been supposed to do the first nine steps in the order that they stated, they would not have numbered them. he also went on to explain that you can begin to do parts of 10, 11, and 12 when you're an hour sober. But steps 1 through 9, that program of recovery, I need to do it like a child doing a follow the dots picture, because if I get to look in the head, I'm gonna sabotage myself. I absolutely assure you that. But the conclusions in step one. By the time I made my first trip to the asylum, and I was in the asylum 18 times in 2.5 years, and by the time I made my first trip to the asylum, the phenomenon of craving that the doctor's opinion talks about had progressed in me to the point where once I started drinking, I truly had physically lost the ability to stop. Both drunk and sober, I've had 12, 14 major surgeries. And I've never had a surgery even get close to hurting me nearly as much as each one of the last couple of hundred times I had come off ethyl alcohol. Now, if you were progressed to that point before you got sober, you don't need an explanation of that. If you weren't, I'm wasting my breath. But if you're an alcoholic, just keep on drinking and you'll learn about it if you live to get there. A lot of us don't even live to get there. But at any rate, I knew by that time, absolutely knew, that once I put any alcohol in my body, it was over. That I was on a fast track to a mad dog death unless something from outside interrupted that, intervened and jerked me up. And got me in a position where when they got alcohol out of my system. So, man, yeah, they're right. I am powerless over this crap. I remember I would picture a ratchet or a gear that's just worn down inside me, that something had worn down inside me that I just could no longer tolerate it, that once I had I had the phenomenon of craving the first drink I ever took, but for over 20 years, the terror of drinking around the clock and you seeing what I was and me having to look at it was just a little bit stronger. Nobody ever had to tell me that drinking in the morning would cure a hangover. I was born knowing that in my bones somewhere. But at any rate, so I thought, man, I've got this paralysis over alcohol. So I understand it now. I get finished getting this crap out of my body and I get out of the asylum. I just won't start that awful cycle up. I won't put that first drink inside me. And of course, within 24 hours of getting out, if I made it out, I was a master at getting ripped in the asylum some way. But if I made it out within 24 hours, I was drunk, you know, every time. Because I was missing a little thing called the mental obsession. Now that sounds like a nice sort of clinical term, a mental obsession. But I want to tell you, for me, the mental obsession is an absolute monster. It's horrible. Because I've got this physical allergy that ensures that if I put any alcohol in my body, it's going to start that awful phenomenon of craving and put me back on the road to that mad dog death. And that mental obsession means this to me. There's something wrong inside me that I can't do anything about, and that no human power can do anything at all about. And if something isn't done about it, it absolutely guarantees that on some day or the other, I will wind up as powerless over the first drink as I am over the second one or the 20th one. So when you start reaching that conclusion about powerlessness, it takes it to an entirely different level. If I put it in there, I'm going to the mad dog death, and no human power can fix that thing inside me that assures that I will put that first one in me and start it over. Excuse me. By the way, on step one, this is not out of the book, but I've got to say it because I don't think I would be alive today if I hadn't finally heard this. Somebody finally explained to me that, yes, indeed, I am powerless over alcohol, but I am not powerless over my elbow. And and what that means is this. You know, we've got to have our meetings and our steps and our prayers and our sponsors. We have to have those things. They're absolutely necessary. But I cannot abdicate the responsibility for what I put in my body. You folks can't knock it out of my hands, and my loving God won't knock it out of my hands. So I had to accept that I was going to have to do the first mature things I'd ever done in my life. I was going to have to not do something that I thought if I didn't, I would just explode and splatter all over the walls. And I was going to have to do some things that I thought if I did them, I might explode on those too, like getting on my knees, for God's sake. But at any rate, another level of the powerlessness. And don't get your singleness purpose knickers all in a knot, because my story is exactly like Dr. Bob's and Bill's. Now, I use different things and probably more of them, but the alcohol was simply the big tent. Everything else was a sideshow. It was somehow to change the effect of the alcohol, maybe increase it, maybe decrease it, maybe help me try to function on the hangovers, but it all went back to the big tent. It all went back to my alcohol. So I would be in one of those asylums, and I'd be coming off my alcohol, and I'd think, you know, it's right, man. I can't tolerate this alcohol anymore. I take a drink, and it's all over. But you know, I take a little dope. I don't turn into a wild-eyed monster and be wanting to throw a brick through a liquor store window at 4 o'clock in the morning, get a drink or something. But by the way, once you learn to drink Listerine, you don't have to do that anymore. It's so when I get out of this, I'll just chip on a little bit of the dope, but I'll leave that old booze alone because I've worn that thing out. And of course, and by the way, when I was in there, and in my mind, I was an alcoholic. You would insult me to call me a drug addict. And of course, within 24 hours, I'd be drunk on everything. Then maybe I'd be in there, and I was coming off a whole lot of the other stuff. And I'd sit in there, and I'd think, you know, I was having some trouble, but things didn't really get all that bad till I started mixing all this other crap with the booze. I believe that's what's messing me up. And what I need to do is just leave all this other crap alone and just go back and drink like a gentleman, for God's sake, like my grandfather said, and I'll be okay. And, of course, right back, like changing staterooms on the Titanic, right back in the same place, you know. And by the way, when I was in that drug addict frame of mind, you would insult me to call me an alcoholic. Just absolute insanity. So the bottom line on that is I'm powerless not over the over alcohol, whether or not I'm drinking it. I'm powerless over all the mind-altering substances. They're all going to eventually take me to the same place. And then that my life had become unmanageable. I had lost my law license. I lived without an address for a year. It may have been, and you young folks don't even know about collect calls, but back then, if you didn't have any money, you had to get somebody that was willing to accept the charges of a collect long-distance call from you. And there may have been a couple of people left that would have accepted the call out of curiosity. But there was nobody that would accept call on anything else. You know, I was in total and absolute disarray. I hadn't seen my only child in, a couple of years. It turned out I wouldn't see or talk to her for a total of over 3 years. And even I wasn't capable of enough self-delusion to think that my life was not a god-awful mess. So I thought, well, I got that. My life is a terrible mess, and I have managed about as poorly as a human being can manage. and I thought I had done step 1B. I call paralysis over alcohol 1A and life become unmanageable 1B. And I hadn't even touched it. I hadn't even got close to 1B. Because if my problem is my life is a mess because I have managed so terribly, I don't need you folks. I don't need this 12-step crap. I certainly don't need your myth of the God thing you're talking about in here. What I need to do is just grab the bull by the horns, by God, and manage it. But it's not what the book says, the ink on the paper again. Doesn't say we weren't managing our lives well. It says they had become unmanageable. You know, I've got a problem driving, and I'm driving terribly. I'm running over people and things, and I'm getting tickets, getting arrested for the way I'm driving. There's some things I can do about that. You know, I can concentrate harder on my driving and go to driving schools to improve my driving skills. And if that's my problem, that may do some good. On the other hand, my problem is my car's undrivable. It just won't go anywhere. I can sit behind that wheel and pray and will myself all I want to, and nothing's happening. I can go to driving schools and get the skills of a Mario Andretti in his prime, and I haven't touched the problem because the car's undrivable. So once I've reached those conclusions, I'm in pretty deep doggy doo-doo. What I've concluded is that if I put alcohol in my body, I'm going to die a mad dog death. And there's something wrong with me that no human power can do anything about that ensures that I will pick up that first drink on some day or the other. My life is a total god-awful mess that because of what's wrong with me, on my own I can do nothing about cleaning it up. And really, short of reaching recovery in AA, I couldn't even have prevented it. Couldn't even have prevented it. You know, all my life I had phantom potential. I was exactly like a fellow that was 6'11", had every attribute to play in the NBA, knew everything, every move, how to do just precisely. He would have been an MVP if he just hadn't have been in that wheelchair. And my alcoholism was a wheelchair that turned what looked like the potential in me to phantom potential. But at any rate, once I've accepted those things, it really doesn't matter how unattractive step two is, because I don't have anywhere else to go. And I honestly believe that if we have not accepted that we are in a humanly impossible dilemma, we have not really done step one of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sort of believe that any time one of us drinks, you know, I don't see, well, maybe you didn't do your fourth or fifth step well. I say, well, yeah, we obviously got a first step problem here any time an alcoholic drinks. So we go back to that. Now, I came kicking and screaming to step two. Believe me, I would not have. If there'd been any other route for me, I wasn't going to it because I was an evangelical agnostic. I mean, a little part of me, I'd gotten, you know, in the depths of my alcoholism. Truth is, there wasn't much of me that even wanted to live. But there was a little part of me that wanted to live. And that little part, by the time I got sober, had known for at least 2 years that the only chance I had of living was to somehow get this thing that you had. And I thought what that meant was that I somehow had to change what I thought, felt, and believed to make it more like what it looked like to me, you thought, felt, and believed. And I had tried every way that I knew, and I couldn't change it a hair. And I remember the second step conversation when I did get sober in the 202 Club there in Nashville. And they told me, well, you'll need to get on your knees every morning and every night and ask a power greater than yourself and thank that power. And I remember the tears coming down my cheeks and looking up at the steps on the wall and explaining just what I told you guys, that I've tried and I can't. And I finally heard them. I'm sure they'd said it 100 times. I said, oh, Don, you've got that backwards, son. We have never suggested that you think, feel, or believe anything. And my mouth probably fell open because I think that's the center of the universe. You know, in nature, if I don't feel like doing the right thing, it doesn't occur to me to go ahead and do it anyway. We got to get me fixed so I feel like doing right. All of my life, I was absolutely convinced that the difference between good people and me was they felt like doing right. And if we could just get me fixed so I felt like doing right, I could be good people too. I know now those good people may not have felt a bit more like doing right than I did. They just did right. And that made them good people, regardless of how much they didn't want to do it, regardless of how much they may have been mumbling under their breath about it. And I didn't, and that made me bad people. Because the thoughts, feelings, beliefs are a will-o'-the-wisp, and the only thing that ever goes in the record book is what I do. But what they said was, you know, said, no, we haven't suggested that. And they said, in the first place, Don, you are far too ill to have any valid thoughts, feelings, or beliefs whatsoever. They said, in the second place, the issue of whether you live or die is going to be determined solely by what you do. The old crazy picture show in the back of your head is not going to have anything to do with it. So they said, if you want to live, get on your knees every morning and every night and say those words and don't worry about what's going on in your head. Having no idea why I was doing it. I was doing it because of that wonderful gift that I told you at the beginning. Embarrassed, even though I was by myself. Sometime in the latter part of April of 1981, I started getting on my knees every morning and night and talking to the wall. I can remember thinking, if they catch you down here talking to this wall, they'll put you back in the asylum and they won't let you out this time. But I kept doing it. And the miracle of the second step happened. You see, the conclusions in the second step are simpler than the ones in the first step, I believe. And the big one is that there is some power out there that has the power to fix the humanly hopeless dilemma that we have just concluded that we're in step one. Well, if I had to reach a point where I intellectually believed that, was comfortable with it, I would have been in that pauper's grave for 36 years. It turned out that when I became willing to act like a person would act if they did believe that, it worked just fine, and the actual belief came tagging along behind that. But if I had insisted on getting my thoughts, feelings, and beliefs fixed first, I'd have been in that pauper's grave. And that's been, by the way, a stalwart of my sobriety. I'm sure there have been a few days, but I think you could count on one hand the number of mornings and nights in the last 36 years and yay number of months that I have not gotten on my knees every morning and every night. Now, at least half the time, I haven't wanted to. A whole lot of times, I could have gotten medical written excuses that I didn't feel like getting down there. And I did get my law license back and so on. And more times than that, I could have gotten affidavits from lawyers, judges, and clients that I didn't have time to get down there. And a whole bunch of those mornings and nights, I've been so scared, obsessed about something that sometimes I can't remember the last word. I just prayed, brain straining and so on. And seems absolutely clear to me it's not doing any good, that the words are bouncing off the walls and the ceiling. Something's worked every single day. And I don't know how else to stay sober other than getting on my knees every morning and every night. And by the way, I took that problem to Cherry when I had begun to come to believe about having problems with my praying and not feeling right, my mind wandering and so on. He said, "Don, your ego's going to kid you yet." He said, "Let's examine this." Are you under the impression that your God is so limited in power that he or she is somewhere wringing their hands and saying, "Oh, I so hope Don stumbles across the magic words. I really want to do this, but I can't do it unless he says it just right." He said, "Or maybe you think God is so clueless that God is unaware of your needs unless you clearly delineate them." And he said, "Don, in your case, I suspect it's far more malignant than that." He said, "In your case, I think down deep, a part of you thinks you'll state it so eloquently you will sway God into doing something God would not do otherwise." He said, "Dummy, the only thing that's of any value is the willingness to humble yourself before God and say please and thank you." And it was explained to me that if I approach prayer, the steps, or any part of my recovery in any way as an intellectual or psychological endeavor, it won't work any better than all the intellectual and psychological approaches have worked on alcoholism itself. This deal is based on action and grace. It's not based on knowledge and merit, but action and grace for me. Step three. Now, I had, approaching step three, of course, was quite an operation, turning my will and life over to the care of God after I had come to believe. It was kind of like a Cecil B. DeMille production on a movie. That's an old movie producer, by the way. I had this idea that it was going to be kind of like God and I would go in this big, ornate room, tell you the truth, kind of like a federal courtroom on steroids, and that God would unroll the entire tapestry of my life. And we'd walk up and down it, and I really thought that I'd say, "God, maybe this," and, "Gee, I hadn't thought of that, Don, that'll be good, we'll do it that way." But I thought we were going to get God's will all mapped out so I could go on spiritual cruise control, could make policy, and always know what to do in any given situation. Well, Cherry would explain some things to me, and sounded like to me the old man was getting senile or something. He would say things like, "Don, if you have to wonder whether you've done a third step, you haven't, because third step's first action step. You've either gone in a room with an understanding human being, because today the book says it's better to meet God alone, but when that book was written, it was intended that the book would wind up in the hands of many people who had absolutely no contact with anybody else on a similar journey. But in today's world, in today's AA culture, we have hundreds of understanding people at our fingertips." So Cherry said, "You've either gone in a room with an understanding person and intended for that to be the watershed moment where you'd and gotten on your knees," and the book doesn't say get on your knees, but Cherry did, so I do, and said the third step prayer. Now, by the way, the book says that the wording of the third step prayer is quite optional, of course, as long as we express the main idea. Yeah. I can't imagine the insanity that I would use the brain that destroyed everything in my life to improve on the third step prayer that saved millions of people. Now, I say the third step prayer just like this, and Cherry tried to get it across to me that the third step doesn't turn anything over to God. It's not designed to turn anything over to God. It's merely a decision, a starting point. And I say, okay, Jerry, you've won the semantic argument here that it's this simple to do that. But I still knew where the complexity was. So I thought I had him nailed with cross-examination. You know, I said, all right, now, tell me how we execute on this decision that you're talking about here. And he said, that's just as simple, Don. Said, all you're committing to do is do the rest of the first 9 steps the way the book says do them, and having done that, live your every day of your life on 10, 11, and 12. And the second thing you're committing is that when what you want to do conflicts with what you know in your heart, with what that divine spark that's in every one of us that knows only the next right thing, the absolute next, nothing further. When those things conflict, you're going to try to take that stitch where the where the divine spark indicates. And he explained, you know, you're probably sitting there thinking that the enemy of the right thing most of the time will be things like greed and lust. Said, maybe 1% of the time. Said, 99% of the time it's going to be fear. It's going to be fear that if you don't take just a little more than really your part, or if you don't shade it just a little bit to make it look better, that you know, things won't work right, that you won't get what you want, or you lose something you don't want to lose. And he said also, most alcoholics are more afraid of looking bad than they are dying. So looking bad will be a huge enemy of taking that next stitch in the right place. And I'm going to talk, I've got a few minutes, I'm going to talk a little bit about my favorite paragraph in the big book. And I believe, I know for me, it is the most important paragraph in the big book. And it's the little paragraph on the bottom of page 62 in the third step. And it's so easy to read over that little fellow. Bill has just spent at that point, when you get to the bottom of page 62, has just spent a couple of pages mentioning some form of the word self over 20 times. And explaining that our problem is self, and that self is a fatal problem, and that it's going to kill us unless something is done about it, and that we can't do anything about it. And then Bill does two things that he does throughout the book. I don't know whether you'd call them literary devices or whatever, but the first one is having set us up by saying, okay, you are hopelessly in the clutches of self, whether you know it or not. And you can't do anything about that. And self's going to kill you if something isn't done. Then he waves a flag at you and says, but we found a way around it. And he says here, we had to have God's help. This is the how and why of it. And then Bill does the other thing that he does over and over in the book. If he thinks something is really important, he'll repeat the same thing in different words immediately after it. I believe this to be the only place in the book where he repeats the same idea 4 times, immediately one after the other. Said, first of all, we had to quit playing God. Well, it's explained to me that when I'm trying to figure out these patterns of my life, which by nature, I mean, that's the way I want to approach everything in my life. Let me figure out this pattern so I'll know where to start stitching. And then I can do, you know, get the whole thing and I'd be a hero here. And the fact is, I've got less chance of comprehending and understanding the patterns of my life than a chimpanzee does of mastering quantum physics. It's just absolutely beyond me. And as far as knowing God's will and getting this idea of God's will in great big chunks, Terry got it clear to me that the only glimpse of God's will I'm ever going to get is in the absolute right now, for my next action. You know, we're all convinced that 5 seconds from now, we're still going to be sitting, you all guys will be sitting here just beginning to fidget a little bit, and I'm going to be up here going on about the third step. But the truth is, in the next 5 seconds, the lights could go out. One of us could have a seizure or a heart attack. Sprinkler system could come on. That'd break it up. a wet drunk could come stumbling in here just raising the devil and disrupt the whole meeting. Police could come in here looking for one of us that hadn't completed our amends. All sorts of things could happen in the next 5 seconds that would absolutely change what I'm convinced God's will is going to be. And yet I want to worry about God's will for next Tuesday and 10 years from now. My job's stitching. The patterns belong to God, and that's what I believe Bill's telling us there. And by the way, he just throws in little three-word sentence there after saying we had to quit playing God. Says it didn't work. In other words, we're not talking about this being a spiritual miscue of some kind. It is an ineffective way to run a human life. It does not work. And then, in case we haven't got it, he tells us this. He says, next we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. Okay? If I'm going to be in play, the director will give me a script. And that script will tell me what my character is supposed to say and how the characters to move and stage and that sort of thing. If I look at that and say, this is no good. Man, if I follow this script, my character is going to come off really, really blah, and the whole play will flop. So I'm going to ad lib. I'm going to do it my way. If I do that, and by the way, the script is the equivalent of that little spark of the divine that tells us only the next right stitch. If I look at script and say, I'm not going to do it that way, I'm going to do it my way, I will have chaos until I do it the way the director told me to, for the simplest reason in the universe. The director has the power, and I don't. And just in case we're not getting it yet, he said that he is the principal, we are his agents. Employer, employee. I'm working for a guy, and he drives me out to a job site early in the morning and says, Don, I want you to dig 3 holes along that land right there. I've got it laid out there for you, and I want you to dig them 18 inches wide, 2 feet deep, and 3 feet apart, and I'll come back and pick you up at lunch. Guy gets in his truck, drives off. I get to looking at it. They don't belong over there. It's too rocky anyway. I'm going to dig them over here. And they don't need to be that size. They need to be this other size. That guy comes back at lunch, I'm going to have chaos. And I will continue to have chaos until I dig the holes exactly like the boss said, dig them, for the simplest reason in the universe. The boss has got the power, and I don't. And just in case we are really, really numbskull and need a fourth time, he says, he is the father and we are his children. Kid is not going to eat the spinach. Kid will not eat the spinach. Well, if the parent is firm, and I have found my heavenly parent capable of just remarkable firmness, that kid is going to eat that spinach, or the kid will have chaos until the kid does. For guess what? The simplest reason in the universe. The parent has the power and the kid doesn't. And then, this whole paragraph is only eight lines long. And then he says, most good ideas are simple. And this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom. Now, I had to look up keystone, and in a stone arch, it's the stones at the very top that are kind of tongue and grooved that they slide together, they hold the entire arch together. Without the keystone, the arch collapses and buildings. It's so easy to read over that. He's saying, hey, this is it. This is the deal. This holds it all together. That I'm going to have to quit trying to do it my way. I'm going to have to quit trying to figure all this crap out. And I'm going to have to listen to and pay attention to that spark of the divine and take just one stitch where I know it needs to be taken, even though my brain's telling me it doesn't look like to me this pattern's going where I want it to go. And then, the next paragraph, top page 63, is the paragraph that contains the beautiful third step promises. And notice this. The first line of that paragraph, immediately following the one we just talked about, is when we sincerely took such a position, meaning exactly what Bill just told us four times in a row. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. And listen to these last promises here. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. I don't know how any promises get any stronger than that, and there's no way to read this book other than that those promises are connected only to what that little paragraph on the page 62 tells me to do. Winding up on the third step here, you know, turning things over to God. My idea of the way it ought to be turning things over to God is that after I've been crushed by all this, I either find a wise man like Clancy or a wise woman like Mari or a good sponsee like Timmy, and I talk to them, and they give me the spiritual key, something that's of such a high level of spirituality that it unlocks the thing, and suddenly it all becomes clear to me, and the pressure's off. Or maybe just by praying and asking God, oh, take this away, God, please take it, that all of a sudden, the sun's out and the bluebirds are flying around and everything is beautiful. Well, doesn't work that way. Do you know how you turn a toothache over to God? You go to a dentist. If you don't believe it, next time you get a toothache, call your sponsor. Do a little inventory on it, pray about it some, and call me and let me know. And go to some meetings on it too. And let me know how that's working. I turn things over to God not by saying, and certainly the prayer is absolutely necessary, but that doesn't turn it over to God to say, God, please take it. I have to do the footwork. And I have to start walking toward the things that I'm afraid of while I'm still scared. I wasted a lot of time asking for God to remove the fear so I could begin acting. Didn't work. And somebody explained to me that if I was hungry and locked myself in a closet and prayed for food, did I believe a hot dog might come squirting through the keyhole? They explained I'd need to get out around some food after I'd prayed, you know, after that. So, I altered my prayer years ago, and it's worked really well for me. Rather than simply asking God to remove my fear, I ask God to give me the strength to act in spite of my fear. And I find that when I pray, which is absolutely necessary, but then get up and immediately start walking toward that thing that needs to be done, that thing that I fear, then and only then does my God remove that fear. I have to couple the action with the prayer before the magic happens for me. Well, I love you guys, and I thank you so much for letting me pontificate up here for an hour and 10 minutes, and I'm going to sit down and look forward to the great speakers the rest of the weekend. Thank you.